On March 9th and 10th, Cleveland Right to Life hosted the third annual Bringing America Back to Life Symposium. Through prayer, action, the vote, and education, we labor to uphold the sanctity of human life and lead our nation back to a culture of life. We hope you will be inspired and motivated as you listen to our guest speakers define and defend the complex issues that make up the pro-life movement.
Bobby Schindler Jr., brother of Terry Schiavo, was our Bringing America Back to Life Symposium keynote speaker at the closing gala dinner in 2012. Before his sister's death, Bobby Schindler was an average citizen. However, after his sister's death, Bobby left his teaching position and became spokesman for the Terry Schiavo Foundation. He has devoted himself to protecting the disabled by raising public awareness of the growing threat of euthanasia. Through his unique experience, Bobby illustrates the inadequacy of our justice system and its diminishing respect for valuable human life. He speaks sincerely and plainly with no agenda other than to honor the memory of his sister and to share his concerns and desires for a more compassionate society. Bobby's message is not just about Terry, it is about the future of our country. Please sit back and enjoy this presentation, free of sponsor breaks or advertisements.
So many injustices happening in our world today after hearing just briefly on the China situation. But I really want to thank all of you for allowing me to be here this evening, and in particular Cleveland Right to Life. And in fact, I have to be a little upset with Molly scheduling me last year with all these speakers ahead of me. It's quite the shoes to fill, because I'm certainly not an expert on this issue. Maria said, I'm just an ordinary, came from an ordinary family, a brother who had to watch something like this happen. I often tell people I'm not a public speaker. And what's that joke? I'm going to spend the next 45 minutes proving that to you. Isn't today where we push the clocks ahead 1 hour? So why don't we just do it right now, and I can just go sit down. This is a heavy issue that I'm going to speak tonight, just like all the life issues. And I'm sorry to. Well, it's a good thing we ate beforehand, right? Because it's not an uplifting topic that I'm going to speak about here tonight. It's really, the reason why I'm here is because of what happened to my sister's death. Our family realized, and we established an organization after her death, because what my family realized during this fight is that this was not an isolated issue. What happened to Terry is happening every single day in our culture, and it continues to happen now as we speak. And I often get a little uncomfortable when people refer to our family or me being here tonight and what our family did to defend Terry was courageous or somehow extraordinary or heroic, because I never thought of it that way. This was something that I'm sure if you were faced with the same circumstances, you would have done the same thing. We just came to the defense of my sister, who we wanted to care for and love for the rest of her natural life. I don't see anything heroic or courageous about what our family did, quite honestly. But I think that's where really the decline of where we've come today as a nation, that a family had to fight so hard just to want to bring their loved one home and care for them. And that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. I'll spend a little time talking about Terry's case, naturally, but what I want to focus on primarily is what I have seen since our family has been battling for Terry, and subsequent to her death, the organization we formed and the families we're helping now, just kind of what I believe are some of the dynamics that are causing this, that more and more people are accepting this type of treatment, if you want to call it treatment, how more and more of us are being indoctrinated into thinking or rationalizing that this is okay. It's quite troubling to me just to see this profound prejudice that exists against people with cognitive disabilities, the elderly, and so many others that we're now justifying every day more and more why this type of care is okay. And I speak tonight in generalities. I certainly am not indicting when I go through these reasons of why I believe this is happening every day in our culture. I'm certainly not indicting everybody. Naturally, there's people in every group that are ardent supporters of the value and dignity of life. But I think as a whole, we are really kind of moving down a very dangerous and disturbing path. Much of the focus today still remains on the abortion issue. And that's a good thing. I mean, I think we've seen the testament of the pro-life organizations and the work they've done over the last 30 years on how more and more of the general public is trending towards pro-life, be calling themselves pro-life. But I think on this issue, on imposed death and euthanasia, I think we are where the abortion issue was back 30 years ago. There's a lot of confusion out there. A lot of people are being educated by our secular media. It's a little tougher issue to present to the public. You look at the abortion issue, and you see a bouncing little baby, and you say, yes, that baby has sacred value. Let's do everything we can to save it. Then you look at someone like my sister, and you say, yes, she has sacred value, but who would want to live that way? And I think that's the question we're dealing with and what is really driving this agenda to accept what is happening to people like my sister every day. So let me just start just by kind of going through and just going back over some of the... I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on Terry's case, unfortunately. Perhaps afterwards we are having questions and answers. If you have any questions specifically, I can answer them for you. But I just wanted to go over a few things of what is continually being reported by my sister in the media every single day. And I'm going to read some headlines recently because they've really been attacking Senator Santorum because he supported my sister back in 2005 when Congress got involved. And I don't know how much you remember about my sister's case or how much you followed it, but Senator Santorum was really leading the charge back then on trying to help my sister, and he's getting just vilified for those efforts today. But my sister was, she collapsed. She was 26 years old, February 25th, 1990. She was not in a coma, not in a brain dead. She did not have a terminal disease. She was not on life support, not in a persistent vegetative state. She was sustained by food and water through a feeding tube, the same thing that we're all sustained by every single day. Now, she needed a feeding tube because she had trouble swallowing, because with her collapse that occurred, she went several minutes and was denied oxygen to her brain, and therefore experienced a profound brain injury. And from that point on, she remained under. She needed care from others in order to live. Now, I just want to say one thing. I don't like to refer to this situation and this issue as an end-of-life discussion. I know it's very easy to categorize it that way, but the fact of the matter is it confuses people because it wasn't an end-of-life situation because Terry wasn't dying. Terry would have, quite frankly, lived a normal lifespan if she was given the opportunity. In fact, I think people would be a little shocked, when I tell them if Terry were alive today, she could be here with us. All she needed was a wheelchair, and we could have taken her anywhere. But the way she was perceived in the mainstream media as being having to be confined to a bed, having little to no quality of life, as some brain-dead vegetable is what I hear over and over again, is not only offensive, but it's inaccurate. And I'll get into that in a little while. But I just wanted to show you, and again, I'm not going to get into a lot of details of Terry's case, but back in the beginning, 1990, 1991, Michael Shiva was her guardian, her husband, he was guardian. My parents had no say in medical decisions because they were not her guardian. So they had no power, if you want to use the power at all, to offer her any kind of medical care or treatment. Michael had all the control in his hands because he was appointed the guardian. And in the beginning, he was getting Terry care. He was giving her rehabilitation therapy. And you can see that she was responding to this. In fact, in her notes, medical notes, in the first 2 years, she was starting to speak words. She was saying, mommy, and stop. The doctors and the nurses were making these notes in her medical charts. In 1991, 92, it all stopped. Michael basically went on this, mission to end her life. And our family's fight with him really started sometime in early 1993. And that's when he basically warehoused her and abandoned her. And you can see comparison here over a better part of 10 years, how Terry deteriorated significantly. Anybody with that type of brain injury where you neglect them and don't give them even range of motion, they're going to deteriorate to the manner in which Terry did. Now, doctors who examined her, and I'm going to show you something in a few minutes, in 2002, thought it was still remarkable on how responsive she was, given the fact that she was really abandoned for as long as she was and basically just confined to a bed. So it was really quite tragic that Michael took this position and was really hell-bent on ending her life, which started in 1992, and that's really when our family started to fight Michael and really didn't make news until he petitioned the court in 2000 to remove her feeding tube. But this is not... not an end-of-life issue. This is an issue we're talking about, and it shouldn't be confused with these end-of-life issues where someone is dying, someone perhaps they have cancer, some type of terminal disease. We are talking about individuals, and I said in the beginning, we are dealing with an issue that happens every single day in our culture. And what is that issue? People that are not dying and are only being sustained by food and water via feeding tubes are being killed every day in our country. So we're not talking about those that are imminently dying, could be hours or a couple days away from death. We're talking about people that, and many of these individuals are American soldiers coming back from war with these that are experiencing these traumatic brain injuries. They're in very similar conditions to that of my sister. So, I think this is an issue that there's so much education that needs to be done because there is so much confusion that still remains in the public. The critical question here tonight is food and water. Many people don't realize through court hearings, Cruzan versus Missouri, even in Terry's situation in the state of Florida, but through various different court cases throughout the nation, that food and water is now, through feeding tubes, is defined as extraordinary care, artificial life support, and medical treatment. It is legally regarded as medical treatment. The provision of nutrition through either a nasal feeding tube or one that goes directly into the stomach is not part of basic care, according to several recent court decisions. That's, I think, one reason why Terry's case is so confusing today, because she's constantly being referred in the media as being on artificial life support without the distinction that what this meant was food and water through feeding tubes, because food and water has been redefined as such, as medical treatment. In fact, I'm going to read something here that should send chills through all of us with how bad it's getting. In a court case not too long ago, an expert witness testified that artificial feeding can include spoon feeding and that food brought on a tray to a patient in a convalescent home can be considered medical treatment because the patient's diet must receive physician's approval. So that's where we're heading with the issue of feeding tubes, food and water through feeding tubes. Feeding tubes are very common today. I found a report as far back as 1987 where upwards of close to a million people, either for a short period of time or those more permanent, need the help of feeding tubes. But the fact that it's been redefined as medical treatment empowers the healthcare professionals to take it away from individuals. And that is the reason we're seeing this happen every single day in our culture. It's because the fact that it's been redefined, it allows doctors and healthcare professionals to take it away from people many times against their own consent. The reason I have Pope John Paul up here, anybody know? He was on a feeding tube 2 days before he died. So... that's why I included the Pope. So why is this happening every day? And these certainly aren't all the reasons why we're seeing this being so widely accepted. But I listed just a few. I want to go through just a few of these. Any one of these categories I could spend the next hour speaking about. But unfortunately, time constraints, I can only spend a few minutes But again, and I paint a broad brush, obviously there are people in the medical profession that are when we work with them, wonderful pro-lifers that value life. But the medical profession, and particularly I want to talk about the persistent vegetative state diagnosis. It's a diagnosis today, and it was used in my sister's case, as a criteria to end people's lives with cognitive disabilities, just like my sister. It was created back in 1972 by the medical profession. The term PVS was coined by a Scottish surgeon, an American neurologist, Dr. Plum. The definition of a persistent vegetative state is a wakeful, unconscious state that lasts longer than a few weeks and therefore is referred to as PVS, persistent vegetative state. It is a completely subjective diagnosis. It is strictly under the discretion of a doctor whether or not a person is in a PVS. In fact, what is so troubling about this PVS diagnosis, aside from the fact that it's dehumanizing and offensive, referring to anybody as a human vegetable, but what's so disturbing is that it's being used as a criteria to kill, and there's been several research studies that have come out in the last couple years that have, because it's so subjective, that have stated and how unscientific it really is, that upwards of 40%, 50% of individuals are misdiagnosed as being a PVS. Now, you tell me that the courts are using PVS in order as a criteria to kill, as it was in my sister's case, and it's being misdiagnosed up to 50% of the time. Imagine if this was applied to those on death row, that there was a 50% chance that they might not be, that they might be innocent. Can you imagine the outrage that we would hear from some of these public interest groups? But yet we're using it to kill our most vulnerable every single day in our country. The bioethics movement and the personhood theory. Again, just another dynamic into why this is so widely being accepted. Has anybody ever heard of the personhood theory? Basically, the personhood theory is there's certain people that meet this criteria that are established by these bioethicist movement that are classified as human non-persons, and therefore we can rationalize killing them. One of the most, I guess, infamous bioethicists, many of you might have heard of him, is Peter Singer. And Peter Singer believes that all these people are human non-persons. And he argues why, and basically because they have no, in general terms, they have no awareness of space or time, and therefore are considered non-persons. In fact, in an excerpt in 1993 book titled Practical Ethics, Singer concluded, quote, killing a disabled infant is not morally equivalent to killing a person. Very often, it is not wrong at all. If you really want to have some fun and read some of what this man believes, go put his name in a Google search, and you'll see just some of the things that he's teaching to our future doctors and nurses at universities. And this is what's so frightening, is that these bioethicists are teaching the personhood theory to our future doctors and nurses that are accepting this, and therefore making quality of life assessments on individuals, whether or not they should live or die, based on what they can or cannot do, and basically if they meet this criteria as being a person or not. In fact, there was a, between Bill Allen, who was a bioethicist at University of Florida, there was a debate between him and Wesley Smith. Now, not all bioethicists are bad. In fact, many of you might have heard of Wesley Smith. He's one of the good ones out there. But he had a debate with Bill Allen on national TV during, I believe it was national TV, during my sister's case, and basically got cut to the chase and said, do you think Terry is a person? And Bill Allen said, no, I do not. And he went on to say, the reason is because my sister had no purposeful interaction with her environment and therefore was in a PVS, therefore was a human non-person. Well, for all those experts, all those doctors, all these bioethicists that believed that my sister was brain dead, had no purposeful interaction, could not respond to stimuli, I was always wondering how they can get around this video, because they can't. And I'm just going to show you a short segment. But the voice you're going to hear, and thanks to Ben for helping me out with this. You've been tremendous help, Ben. But what you're going to hear is Terry's neurologist. This was in 2002, and you're going to ask Terry to open her eyes. And you're going to see what happens when he asks her to do that. Now, according to the PVS diagnosis, according to all these pundits and experts that believe my sister was unresponsive, she should not have been able to do what she did here.
Terry, open your eyes up. Open your eyes. Terry, open your eyes. There you go. Good. Good. Good job. Good job, young lady. Good job.
Now, that should have been enough to save my sister, because the court fight came down to if she was in a PVS, kill her. If she wasn't, she could live. And that right there disproves the definition of being in a PVS. It's a diagnosis that needs to be eliminated. We don't refer to human beings as vegetables. I refer to it as the V word because it's so offensive and it discriminates, and it's really a word. And in fact, if you can take anything away from here tonight, if you hear in conversation, anybody refer to my sister as being in a vegetative state or a vegetable, it really needs to be corrected, because we do not apply that label to human beings, particularly created in the likeness and image of our Lord and Savior. But these, thank you. But I just want to put a few pictures up here of people that are, by these bioethicists, that are classified as human non-persons. And does anybody know I have Ronald Reagan up there? Because he has Alzheimer's. That's absolutely right. Ethics committees. So again, something flying under the radar, something many people don't realize. Ethics committees are now formed in many of the hospitals, if not all, across our nation. Ethics committees can unilaterally make decisions to end life-sustaining treatment. Despite what our wishes are, despite what our medical decisions, we're asking for certain medical decisions, despite those that are advocating for us, that are our medical proxies, we're so concerned about Obamacare, and believe me, I am too, and it will certainly get much worse under government-controlled health care, according to all the experts. But people need to realize that it is happening now. Every day, people's medical rights are being eroded more and more. Every one of us in this room, that the ability for us to make medical decisions on the care that we want is being eroded more and more every day. In fact, let me just read this about, I single out Texas, and depending what state you live in, some are worse than others. But let me just read to you about Texas. Currently, Texas law allows for a physician to withdraw life-sustaining treatment, including food and water, from a patient despite the patient's advance directive or express wishes. Once the physician decision is made and then approved by the ethics committees at the hospital, the patient and or family have only 10 days to find a transfer to another facility or another physician. Although I single out the Texas situation, this is not only a Texas problem. Ethics committees practicing euthanasia is a very real threat in every hospital, nursing facility, and care center in America and essentially throughout the world. Futarian ethics has seeped into every medical institution. The Futarians are those who make arbitrary judgments about a person's quality of life. And this mindset has infiltrated all of our medical schools and institutions and is the reasons we are now dealing with the problems of ethics committees, not only here in Texas, but throughout the nation. Again, something I could spend a lot more time on and probably warrants more time on. But this is an issue that quite possibly can affect every single one of us in this room at some point in our lives. And we better understand the significance that what is happening in our country today. Death panels are here. This Sarah Palin claiming death panels with Obamacare, well, what people didn't realize, and all the, and maybe those words were a little inflaming. But what Sarah should have said is not in the future. They're happening right now, and they're basically called ethics committees that exist in the hospitals throughout the country. My favorite, the media in Hollywood. I don't think I need to spend a lot of time on this. I think we're all on the same page when it comes to the media in Hollywood and how this culture, this industry is basically educating our general public because we're too lazy anymore to educate ourselves on these fundamentally important issues such as life and death. But I just want to spend a few minutes just to show you how even to this day they are still misreporting, sometimes offensively, which you're going to see in a moment, my sister's case. Just to start off, Nat Hentoff, many of you might have heard of him. He's been in the industry for over 50 years. He's an expert on civil rights. He's actually an atheist. And back in 2003, this was the title of one of his articles. He was an ardent supporter of Terry's rights, her civil rights. And he saw what was happening to Terry's case back in 2003 and how he referred to it as journalistic malpractice. Now, he was saying this about his colleagues and how they were already starting to inaccurately misreport Terry's situation. And to this day, they continue, which is why there remains so much confusion about her situation. These are just some of the icons I found, and I could have probably done 3 or 4 pages of this, that have either inaccurately spoken, reported, what have you, done a documentary, done a story, done an episode on my sister's case that was either inaccurate or factually wrong or downright offensive, which I'm going to show you here in a moment. George, I can never pronounce his last name. I always get him mixed up with the Sesame Street character. Snuffleupagus, whatever his name is. But he went on the air, and this was in 2009, and said Terry Schiavo's autopsy proved she was brain dead. That's absolutely false. In fact, our attorneys wrote him a letter and got him to retract that, although he did it in a very backhanded way. But nevertheless, we did get him to come on the air and retract that she was not brain dead. Again, I refer back to the video of my sister that I showed here just a little while ago. This was a story, a headline that came out in 2011. It was a research study. Someone please tell me what this means. But you can see this chipping away and how it desensitizes us to the value and dignity of people with cognitive disabilities, to the value and dignity of the elderly and so many others, to constantly refer to them as vegetative, as vegetables, and how dehumanized. This is the same issue as abortion, ladies and gentlemen. It's the same people and organizations. It's the same verbal engineering. Dehumanize the unborn baby, dehumanize the disabled. No value, no worth, right? It's a financial problem. Well, it is. In their mind, it is a financial problem. But the same thing. Look at Terry, useless eater. She's not giving anything back. She's only draining our society of hard-earned money that we need to spend on people that are worthy. But someone explained to me what this vegetative patients are judged as more dead than dead. There was actually money spent to come up with this brilliant findings, whatever it was supposed to find. It's not just an isolated case where they refer to people as being brain dead. This happened to my a case we were involved in of baby Joseph. This baby was not brain dead. In fact, it was breathing and living on without any type of machines at all. It didn't need a feeding tube, just like my sister. But again, they referred to him as being brain dead. This is done deliberately. They do not do this by accident. I can't tell you how many times I've had to deal with the media and ask them for a correction. Sometimes they're very nice and they will correct it. Other times they've been very arrogant and refused to correct something that is medically false. I want to show you what happened. This was in 2010, I believe. This was the Family Guy. And I don't know who we should be more upset at. Producers like Seth MacPherson, I believe is his name, for creating this type of garbage? Or should we be more upset at us, at our nation? Because if it wasn't for us watching this, these guys wouldn't exist. So really, is it our fault that we constantly go back to watch these shows, give money to these advertisers, so it continues? But this was in 2010. It's a little fuzzy, but just to set it up, they did a musical, 2010, just less than 2 years ago. They did a musical. This was the introduction to the show. As you can see, the credits are still rolling. This was a musical about my sister. And listen to the words, how offensive. Not only was it inaccurate to describe my sister, it was downright offensive, not only to our family, but all the hundreds of thousands of other families that are caring for cognitively disabled individuals like my sister Terry.
I am so excited for Stewie's first play.
Don't you think it's a little soon for a musical about Terry Schiavo?
Or too late?
Shh, it's starting.
doing?
She's a vegetable.
I hate vegetables.
Don't worry about her, Mr. Shivo. She's being kept alive by medical science.
Gee, look at all this stuff. How does it all work?
Well, I'll tell you.
This one keeps her liver clean. This one checks her pee.
How about this one over here?
Oh, that's just the TV. This one checks her heart rate. This one checks her veins. And this dispenses gravy for her mashed potato brains.
Oh, 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 Terry Shivo is kind of a lipo. What a lively little bugger.
Maybe we should just unplug her.
Terry Shivo is kind of a lipo. The most expensive plant you'll ever see.
There's only one solution. It's in the Constitution. We've got to pull the plug.
No regard for my family. My mom accidentally saw that. There's some things that just aren't funny. And but that's the stuff we're dealing with, ladies and gentlemen. And that's the stuff that's being taught to our kids, because kids watch this show every day. And I mentioned Rick Santorum. Let me just read some of the recent headlines about Rick Santorum. All of these are, and there was more, I only picked out a few. All of these headlines included a story about my sister, either inaccurately or in an offensive way, to somehow attach him to Rick Santorum to get people to, obviously they know what they're trying to do, to bring him down, to lose credibility, whatever you want to, the way you describe it. Rick Santorum just can't win, Minneapolis Star Tribune. Is birth control fight a Terry Schiavo moment? Washington Blog. Is the GOP falling into the Terry Schiavo trap? The Moderate Voice. The dirt on Santorum, Daily Mail. Rick Santorum and the Terry Schiavo disaster, Atlantic Journal Constitution. The GOP farm team brings the wig nut once more, Esquire Magazine. Santorum, really? He's atop the GOP heap. Are they nuts? Philadelphia Daily News. Santorum surges, raises cheers from Camp Obama. Bloomberg. I don't think I need to say much more about the media. But that's stuff that our family is having to deal with every day. And finally, the last part of this dynamic is the clergy and theologians. Not to get into a lot of detail, but we got, and this is, I don't know how many are Catholic in here this evening, but in the battle for my sister's life, we got no support from our local diocese, our Bishop Robert Lynch. We are not getting the leadership that we need, not even close to leadership that we need on this issue. We were not only getting non-support from our bishop and clergy members. We did have a few. I'm not speaking about everybody. We were, in fact, the Vatican, about a month before Terry was killed, came out with some very, very strong words, using the word of, like, murder to what was happening to Terry. But Bishop Robert Lynch gave us no support whatsoever. In fact, he was really, in many ways, working against our family and trying to save my sister's life. But just to clarify something, what is the Catholic Church position on food and water? Despite our secular definition of food and water as being medical treatment, Pope John Paul II came out in an allocution in 2004. It wasn't new Catholic teaching. It was clarifying already existing Catholic teaching that food and water, you can look at it any way you want to in the secular world, but the Catholic Church is going to recognize it as basic care. In fact, the allocution is quite beautiful. It was March 20th, 2004. It's not that long, if you have any interest in reading it. Our website has it. But he basically goes through and so eloquently talks about just the dignity of a person like my sister, and how he talks about food and water is never considered an artificial means or a medical act. It should be considered morally obligatory to people like my sister that are not dying and only need food and water through feeding tubes in order to sustain their life. So, not to spend a whole lot of time on this, but the Catholic Church is crystal clear. And if you get any other opinions on how the Church looks at people like my sister that need food and water through feeding tubes, other than morally obligated to care for them, then they are not talking about proper adhering to the proper and very clear Catholic teaching on this issue. Finally, the last 2 weeks of my sister's death, I don't think I could be up here and describe properly what it was like to watch and walk into a room and watch my sister starve and dehydrate to death the way she was. It was one of the most ghoulish, horrible things a family ever had to experience, something no family, particularly parents, should ever have to watch their child, their daughter, die this way. I don't know what was more difficult, seeing Terry die this way or having to watch my parents walk into a room and watch their daughter die and not do anything to help her. We were not even allowed to give ice chips to my sister. We would have been arrested immediately if we tried. We had armed guards that walked into the room with us. We had to go through 3 checkpoints the last 2 weeks at the hospice facility. 3 checkpoints with armed policemen that would check us before we go in to visit my sister. There were snipers on the roofs of hospice. It was absolutely circus, all to ensure that Terry would die this horribly barbaric death, so much so, not to get into a lot of the details of how she looked, but she had blood in her eyes about a day before she died. People asked me what time would she look like. The only thing I can think of is those that were Auschwitz, these pictures up here that you see, and quite honestly, I thought it was much worse. We can't even do this to a dog. It's considered a felony crime if we do this to a dog, to an animal. And we certainly, it's cruel and unusual punishment if we do this to our most heinous criminals on death row. But yet, every single day, we're doing it to our most vulnerable. I keep saying over and over, the elderly, the chronically sick, cognitive disabilities. My dad died in 2009, August, and my dad was never quite the same after my sister's death. And he confided in me. My dad was a wonderful man. I don't know if anybody ever met him in here. But in public, he was always able to keep a good face on. But privately, he suffered terribly from what happened to my sister. In fact, he came to me one time and said privately that he was never able to forgive himself for not being able to do to protect his daughter. And there's no doubt in my mind, my dad died of a heart attack, heart failure, that the reason he died is because of what happened to his daughter. How many people, you take all the dynamics, everything that I'm saying here tonight, how many people are we talking about? I think it's hard to know the numbers of the people that could fit into this category, quality of life, human non-persons, you name it, and what's happening and how many people can be affected and are accepting this. I said earlier, who would want to live this way? Nobody would choose to live with a disability if given the choice, but we're asking the wrong question because there are people living this way. And it really falls upon us then. It's a reflection upon us on how we're going to care for individuals in our culture today. And look what we're talking about. People with traumatic brain injuries. That doesn't even include people like my sister with closed head injuries. Those that experience brain injuries from lack of oxygen. We're just talking about traumatic brain injuries. 1.5 million people a year. And again, many of them are American soldiers that experience brain injuries. We're looking at people with ALS that need feeding tubes towards the latter part of their disease, and the thousands of people that have this illness. Look at those with Alzheimer's, 2.4 million, and they're looking for this number to explode in the near future. The elderly, who are so much vulnerable today, and the millions of people that could possibly be at risk if they ever find themselves in situations where they need some type of care that is deemed futile or is not going to fit into the cost of the cost now or when the government controls our health care. I'm sorry, that didn't come through, but that was the title there is from Dr. Leo Alexander, who was a chief medical consultant at Nuremberg War trials after World War II. And he wrote in Medical Science under Dictatorship about the experiments undertaken by the Nazi doctors in concentration camps. This was prior to the Holocaust, and this attitude that changed among the doctors that eventually led to the Holocaust. But what was happening, it was a T4 program where tens of thousands of medically and physically inferior individuals were being killed, just like what we're doing today, ladies and gentlemen. If you don't think the parallels, what's happening today in our healthcare facilities are that of what happened back prior to the Holocaust, and I think we're all being naive. This is what Dr. Leo said back during the Nuremberg trials after World War II. He said, whatever proportions these crimes finally assumed, it became evident to all who investigated them that they had started from small beginnings. The beginnings at first were merely a subtle shift in emphasis in the basic attitude of physicians. It started with the acceptance of the attitude, basic in the euthanasia movement, that there is such a thing as life not worthy to be lived. And that's precisely what's happening today in our culture. Look at some of the recent headlines. And I'm not going to go here and read every single one of them. But if you read these headlines, and these are recent. These within the last probably 6 weeks I pulled these off the internet. And I've put them on our website. You can see just how disturbing and chilling some of them are. It's an issue, I believe, that is really not being accepted with the magnitude and the amount of people that this is, could potentially affect as it might. This is a case our foundation was, our organization was involved in not too long ago. And this was a woman who was trying to find help, and she called us to help find, I believe it was her aunt. And if you read this, I'll just read it to you because this is so chilling. I just got off the phone with my mom who is with my aunt, and her vitals are like what people her age would dream of. Temperature of 98.2, blood pressure of 126 over 73, oxygen level 94, heart rate is 88. Then she said this, she's awake and conscious and being starved and dehydrated to death. And that's exactly how she died. We could do nothing to stop it because her guardian was allowing this to happen. And we could do nothing to prevent it from occurring. These are the types of situations we're dealing with at our organization every single day. And what we're trying to do now is to be the organization with the resources we have to help these families by giving them access to attorneys or doctors to help them fight against what's happening in so many of our healthcare facilities across our nation. And we are extremely busy. I don't want to, I know tonight, a lot of doom and gloom. I mean, I said it's a heavy subject, I said in the beginning, and it really is. But there's so many blessings that have come our way fighting against, not only for my sister, but even subsequent then, the support that our families receive. I'm sure for many of you here today, and the support we continue to receive, there is hope out there. There's hope in the pro-life movement. I can't tell you, I've spoken in over 200 cities, and really outside the United States too, and the people that come up, the heartwarming stories that I hear on how Terry has changed their lives, I can't tell you what it does for me, and it allows me individually and my family, when we get these emails, to continue this fight, knowing that we are in a position to help families. And if you know anybody that has cared for someone that needs this type of care, whatever the reason, they look at them as treasures. I have never been so touched by talking to families that are caring for those with cognitive disabilities, and they look at themselves as the lucky ones, that God has blessed them. I mean, in the beginning it's tough to come to accept the terms that they're going to have to be dedicating their lives to caring for these individuals in these types of situations. But to hear them and to tell them, to hear their stories and how they feel they are the lucky ones, that God has blessed them because they're able to every day show the compassion and the love to their loved one because of their vulnerability. And I think that's what's being lost here. The people that are out there saying these things, these horrible and cruel things, and doing everything they can to dehumanize and say these so many things that are so untrue, have never been in a situation of having to care for someone in these types of conditions. And I think until they do, they won't know what it really means to be able to love somebody unconditionally. So I know I left some time for some questions and answers. And please go to our website, lifeandhope.com. You can see how you can really read about this issue. And we update it every day. And to see how prevalent it's become in our culture today. I just want to close. And again, I want to thank you. You know what? Let me just give you one story real quick, and then I'll close with this one thing I want to read. I talk about the blessings, and I think it's something I don't always share with you, but I think it it might touch you all in a different way, but I think it does a lot to show you really the hope that exists out there. And I don't know why this story I pick it, but it still to this day meant and still means so much to me. I could probably relate 1,000 stories to you on how I've been touched by what happened to my sister. But this was during my sister's two-week starvation death. And not to get into the story about I left my Catholic faith and I came back to it during my sister's situation. In fact, I often say everybody trying with all these emails that I get about my sister and how she's touched and helped so many people, I often say that all this fight and all this effort to save my sister's life, and look what happened. She was saving all of us in some ways, because she did with me. I mean, she brought me back to Christ and back to my faith. But it was during those 2 weeks, obviously you can imagine what we were going through with the circus that was going on and while my sister was being killed this way. But I think it was the first or second day into my sister's starvation and dehydration, and I get a phone call on my cell phone, and I still don't know how to this day how he got my cell phone number. But I pick up the phone and I said hello, and he said, "Hello, Bobby. This is Jim." And I said, "Hello, Jim." And I said, "Jim who?" And he said, "Jim Caviezel." And Jim Caviezel is you might know, he's played Jesus Christ in the Passion of the Christ, yes. So he called and he expressed his support, and would you believe that every day for the next 2 weeks he called and prayed with me. It wasn't just for a minute or two. We were on the phone like 15-20 minutes. He has such a faith in the Blessed Mother that's can't be described. And I can't tell you how much he helped me and got me through something, obviously, that was a very difficult time in my life. And ironically enough, it was the Passion of the Christ, before I even spoke with Jim Caviezel, that brought me back to my faith, seeing that movie. And then to have him call me on the phone, and I was fortunate to meet him after my sister's death, to thank him for his help. And to this day, I can't tell you how much that meant to me. And so many stories like that. So our family has been blessed in so many ways through what my sister went through. It was horrible. It was evil. But the way our family has been blessed by the friendships we've made, I mean, even here tonight, the people that I've met, I can't tell you how much it's helped me. Let me just close by saying, reading this. This is from a book called Power of the Powerless, A Brother's Lesson. It's by Christopher DeVick, and he was a school teacher, and he had a brother who was in a very similar condition to my sister. And I just like ending my talk with just an excerpt from his book. I grew up in the house where my brother was on his back in his bed for almost 33 years, in the same corner of the room, under the same window, beside the same yellow walls. Oliver was blind, mute. His legs were twisted. He didn't have the strength to lift his head, nor the intelligence to learn anything. Today I am an English teacher. And each time I introduce my class to the play about Helen Keller, the miracle worker, I tell my students about Oliver. One day during my first year teaching, a boy in the last row raised his hand and said, "Oh, Mr. DeVick, you mean he was a vegetable." I stammered for a few seconds. My family and I fed Oliver. We changed his diapers, hung his clothes in bed linen. We bathed Oliver, tickled his chest to make him laugh. Sometimes we left the radio on in his room. We pulled the shade down over his bed in the morning to keep the sun from burning his tender skin. We listened to him laugh as we watched television downstairs. We listened to him rock his arms up and down to make the bed squeak. We listened to him cough in the middle of the night. Well, I guess you can call him a vegetable. I called him Oliver, my brother. You would have liked him. Again, thank you, everybody. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to be here and listen to me tonight. I'm very humbled by being invited to speak at these events. And I can't tell you how much it helps me to have the opportunity to thank you for not only the work you're doing in the pro-life movement, but the help and the support that you gave my family during our battle to save my sister's life. So thank you very much, and God bless you all.
Wow. Wow, Bobby. I've had a couple of days of attempting to learn the church order, and I don't know if a lay person can say this in the church order, but Lord, have mercy. Christ, have mercy. Wow. What I've done with the questions is I've separated them out into a couple of groups because some of them are a little personal of nature, and you actually answered one of them in your closing remarks because they wanted to know how you're doing spiritually, and I think he's pretty much answered that your sister was extremely important to lead you back to the eternal, and that's tremendous. I have to also put the questions of the youth in front of other questions, so this one's a little bit more technical, if you will. It's about what you mentioned about the ethics committees. Can these committees override the legal wills of medical patients?
Yes. Quite. Depending on what state you live in, depending on state law, it makes it easier or harder to do this. But to generally answer that, yes, it can. They can.
All right. Some of these are a little more tender in nature. One of them is about Michael Schiavo. If he agreed with you, would Terry have died?
If he agreed with us?
Yes, if he had agreed with you.
No. I mean, our only intention from the beginning, and I don't know if I said this or not, but our only intention from the beginning was to bring Terry home and care for her. I think I said that. So if Michael would have agreed with us, then we would have been able to accomplish that.
You've been listening to Bobby Schindler Jr., who was our grand finale keynote speaker at our 2012 Bringing America Back to Life gala dinner. Bobby is the brother of Terry Schiavo. Before his sister's death, Bobby Schindler was an average citizen. After her death, Bobby left his teaching position and became spokesman of the Terry Schindler Schiavo Foundation. He has devoted himself to protecting the disabled by raising public awareness about the growing threat of euthanasia. Please visit their website for regular updates on end-of-life issues at www.terriesfight.org.
If you are encouraged and edified by what you hear, please accept our invitation to become an active and informed member of the pro-life movement. There are many opportunities to serve. Visit our website at www.clevelandrighttolife.org or contact us at 216-661-3000, extension 11, or at lifenews@clevelandrighttolife.org. And please consider sharing this audio file with someone.